The following podcast is an Embassy Row production. We are here today to bury the idea that comedy is dead in NYC. Mom.
I'm still working, okay? And instead of getting paid in drink tickets, I'm passing the same $10 back and forth between 20 people. So yeah, I've made it.
Comedy is what makes New York, New York, okay? Like the smell of pee on an MTA elevator.
We are the comedy capital of the world. Chicago? Nope. Los Angeles? Get out of here. Austin? You wish, Joe Rogan.
Before 2020, comedy clubs in New York are where the best of the best go to workshop their material, and the worst of the worst bring their Tinder dates.
It's where 5 minutes on a late night show can change your entire life, and where an open mic can bring you slammed right back to reality.
The Comedy Cellar.
Caroline's.
Stand Up New York.
The Stand.
Comic Strip Live. This city is the only place in the world where Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Sarah Silverman, Michael Che, and Amy Schumer can all ignore you on the same night.
The club system in this city gave a financial home to hundreds of comics, waitstaff, bartenders, and bookers.
That's just the pro scene. The amateur and alt scenes are behemoths on their own. Before 2020, there were probably over 50 open mics a day running across multiple comedy scenes in the five boroughs. Really, four boroughs? Sorry, Staten Island.
Bar shows and alternative venues like Union Hall, The Knitting Factory, UCB, Littlefield, and Caveat gave a performance space to talent who didn't quite fit into the club circuit.
And then coronavirus happened, and like a flashing light at the end of a set, comedians and venues were forced to get off stage for a while until the world was ready to come back. Zoom shows sprang up, then rooftops like Tiny Cupboard, or this guy I know named Jeff who just had a roof. And then park shows. And though some were fun, like our weekly park show in Central Park every Saturday at 8 p.m., I will not be shamed for this plug, comedy just wasn't the same.
Good plug, good plug. Like getting bangs right after a breakup, comedy sounded the same, but looked completely different than how we remembered it. Which begs the question, is comedy dead in NYC?
I'm Jackson Clemens, comedian, writer, and commentator on BuzzFeed, and honestly, I don't think New Yorkers are Jets fans. I think they're just really into BDSM.
My name is Eitan Levine. I'm a comedian and writer from New York. I've written for the New York Times and Amazon, and I'm a Jets fan.
Ladies.
This is NYC is Dead, a podcast focused on proving how alive this city actually is. Every week, we speak with New Yorkers that have direct influence and insight into the industries that this city is famous for, and hear how it's changed in the wake of 2020.
At the end of each episode, we'll get a little closer to answering the question, is NYC dead? Cool thing about comedy, Eitan, is that we both do it.
Yeah! We're what the industry calls staples, okay?
Hey, and I'm not talking Office Depot here, okay?
We're a full staples, baby. We got your paper, we got your printers, and we got some office snacks for you.
Every time we get off stage, someone looks at us and goes, that was easy. So, boom.
You know, Drexton, sometimes I like to think that I got off stage and the audience is like, wow, that was complicated calculus. That was just an elegant dance of wordplay and symbolism and hot takes. And boy, did he say the right stuff about Israel.
It was like watching the Nutcracker performed by a Nutcracker.
So over this past year, watching what happened to this scene, because, you know, coronavirus happened and shut everything down. And one of the people who was around through a lot of the reopenings and everything was our friend Matt Broussard, Matthew Broussard. You know him from his uber famous Instagram, Monday Punday.
Also from Comedy Central and everywhere else. This man is constantly on tour. He's constantly bringing the funny. And he was one of the few comics that really stayed around during the entire pandemic and performed in parks and on rooftops and in the cold in the winter. And he's genuinely like a really fun guy.
He's also, once again, I'll say it's stunning.
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 And he's Jewish, which I don't understand because, I mean, he jokes about this, but he looks Aryan. Okay. He is a beautiful Aryan man, but a Jewish.
I have three recurring dreams, okay? One of them, I'm on a beach in Tulum.
That's one.
Yeah. The second one, I am being chased by every demon.
That's two.
The third, I am Matthew Broussard, okay?
Wow.
I wake up in Matthew Broussard's body. I just get to live a day as Matthew Broussard. It's a lot of eating oats, let me tell you.
Anyways, this is an interview with comedy staple, just like us, Matthew Broussard.
I started drawing Monday Punday at my desk at work in 2010. And started putting them online. And then I think a year later, I made it into a website. And probably a couple of years after that, someone made it into an app. So it took off from there. For those who don't know the context, mondaypunday.com is my website. I put up puns, visual pun. They're more puzzles than puns, in my opinion, but they're like cartoon puns. And you have to figure out what the phrase is. And yeah, it was something a teacher did in high school. So I kept making them. The teacher would take them from students. We'd start class with us. And that was how that started.
Does she know that you...
She knows.
Okay, good.
Schwartz, but not a Jew.
Well,
a nun, ironically.
A nun named Schwartz?
A nun named Schwartz.
Like a Jew named Christian. Anyways, just to kind of get a background, like what was your schedule like and how much touring were you doing before coronavirus? I guess like cut to January of last year.
A club or two a month, a weekend, a college or two a month during the school year. Random film projects, you know, usually nothing that was more than 1 or 2 days of shooting, but I just shot a movie. And was starting to pick up some a little bit of acting work, no like serious regulars or anything, but very busy, a lot of stand up, especially in New York. I was going up every night. I think I was starting to count. I was getting like 40 sets a month. So, you know, averaging more than one set a night and unappreciative of all of it.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
Taking it all for granted.
Just go to all these things. I'd pay my left arm to do some stuff that like a year ago, I was like, this is bullshit that I got to take the L train at 2 p.m.
Right. 40 shows a month. Yeah. That is 80 drink tickets. Okay. That is so much money. A lot of liquor. For people who like don't know much about comedy, the primary pay for a lot of shows that aren't big reputable clubs is two drink tickets for very watered down drinks and the respect of the six people that saw you that night.
I actually used to get paid about $400 a bar show. I was pulling in about $130,000 a year on bar shows. Yeah, nice little nest egg for myself. So then what was your like first holy crap, everything's ending moment?
Bit of a backstory. Early 2020, this is a story about setbacks in 2020. Early 2020, I was selected to be one of 32 comedians to compete for a new comedy competition show, where over the course of 5 weeks, we would whittle down the herd and the winner got a special. I was one of the 32 picked. They flew me out to LA. I can't name the network, but a very big one.
Breitbart TV.
Yeah.
OAN. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was very excited and I really felt that was going to be a career changer for me. And here's how far I got. 1 week. I bombed my first set. I got kicked off the show immediately. And I threw a fit when they told me I lost. On camera, I insulted the network. I insulted the production. I just lost it, like in a way I never have before.
Wait, what were you saying? What kind of stuff were you saying?
I just said, this isn't a comedy show. This is a reality show and you lied to us. I get on a plane and I'm reeling with how, not just how poorly the set went, but the fact that I torched bridges with the most powerful entity in comedy. And the night I flew home was March 11th. 2020. I get a call from my agent on Monday. I fly to Florida to meet my girlfriend. And I get a call on Monday and my agent's like, yeah, the show, they're halting production. We don't know when they'll restart. We don't know if they'll restart. And I was like, oh no. So 2020 was a setback and then COVID came and now I'm okay.
So what did you do to supplement? Did you start doing Zoom shows? What as far as like things starting to like reopen or not even reopen, but like into the, like the summer months of 2020, what was that starting to look like for you?
So I did a month in Florida. I actually spent a month and went up and stayed a month with my mom in Atlanta, just as payback to my girlfriend of like, I'm going to subject you to this now. And then we got back to New York. And I think
you thought your family was bad.
Came back to New York. And I remember not being here very long. And then the Park show started and I was so grateful. It was, you know, we complain a lot, but it was just, compared to no spots at all, compared to Zoom shows, it was like, this is beautiful. At least I'm outside. At least I'm interacting with people. And I started doing as many of those as I can. Then the rooftop shows started happening and then Tiny Cupboard. And then I was performing most nights in safe spaces. I did go to Texas in June because they were wide open. And I was like, well, it seems like nothing's happening here. So maybe COVID only hits the Northeast and Texas is safe. And I went out and did shows there for a couple of days. Got COVID.
You got COVID during those Texas shows?
Yeah. Like the day we flew back, when we landed, our friend texted, hey, I just tested positive. So we went and got tested and, you know, we tested positive, had a, Laura and I both had a light case and just stayed inside for 2 weeks. And when we were allowed to, we went back to park shows.
That set must have been real good, Matt. That set was the best goddamn set of your life.
I'm such a dirtbag. I flew to Texas to get COVID.
No, the crazy thing, I was doing so many shows outdoors. There was like a moment where I was like, okay, this is kind of risky. Like, I want to do comedy. I need to be doing comedy, but this feels risky. And then I actually ended up getting COVID from a homeless lady on the train. That's how I got COVID. I was doing 4 shows a week, probably. Like most nights I was doing a show. And then none of those shows got me COVID. On the way to like a Christmas party, this lady coughs on me. And I'm like, that was it. And like 2 days later, I'm out.
The lady was actually, it was 600 bats in a jumpsuit that coughed on.
I just picture you slicing her open and it fly out like the bad guy in A Nightmare Before Christmas.
What was funny was like, it was because she wasn't wearing a mask. She was the only one on the train not wearing a mask. It was like a packed 7 train. And she like coughs and everyone freaks out. We're like, yo, what are you doing? And I shit you not, she just starts listing symptoms. Like she's like, it hurts to move. My body aches. It's just, it hurts. And I can't stop coughing and I want to eat, but nothing tastes right. And I'm just like, you have COVID. And like, I wish I was making this up. And her boyfriend was just rubbing her like, it's going to be okay, baby. It's going to be okay. Yeah. And I was like, this is it. I've got COVID. And I had a mask on and everything on the train. And like, I was just like, it's in my eye. I got it. It's over for me. And I got COVID literally 2 days later. Speaking of like comedy in COVID, did your material change at all during this time?
Yes, I started. You mean you had to talk about COVID. So I wrote some jokes about it. Doing those park shows, it was just so tough that you didn't want to do your best material. So it forced me to play around more and do jokes that were newer and less built out. And there was no need to impress anyone during these shows, these rooftop shows. It wasn't like you were doing you're going to a club where they might not book you again if you bomb. No one was killing at most of these shows. So it was this freedom and this, it sounds cheesy, but like that I could keep going, that I could stop doing comedy for so long and still be okay mentally and financially, made me feel like I'm not as desperate as I thought I was. And I should be less afraid on stage to do what I want to do. And also bombing that set like really affected me, that it was the last set and it was like the last word you hear before silence. It just keeps echoing in your head. I spent so long rerunning this set that didn't go the way I wanted it to with that show. And in my mind, I was cowardly in the material I chose. It was general, it was clean, it wasn't personal in any vulnerable or edgy way. So I really wanted to come back swinging a little more. And these park shows were the perfect place to really play around with that.
Do you think that stylistically comedy is going to change moving forward? Like, I feel like because everyone had such a different COVID experience, I think that comedy is going to get a lot more introspective than it ever has been.
Yeah, I never thought about that. I would imagine you're right. I would think also because of the harshness of COVID, the gravity of what we're dealing with, I think comedy is going to be more light and playful. I think we were seeing a lot of social issues creep into comedy during the Trump administration, especially for cities, because we're so alarmed at what was happening in the government that we use comedy as a platform to speak out against these things, which I don't think is very funny. it's a little harsh and heavy. And now I think because of COVID, because of how tough it was, and that we have Biden in power who more city folk agree with, we feel okay being a little naughtier and playful and conservative in a fun way.
I think dumb stuff. I think stuff now is going to be very highbrow and very, very, very lowbrow. Like the Eric Andre, like that Bad Trip movie, like that level of, you know, it's going to be like that kind of stuff. Because I think people are going to be more inclined to laugh at dumb now.
So there was a good thing of like Ivan Reitman's parents, like we're World War II or like Holocaust survivors, and all of his movies have happy endings and couples falling in love. And then Jason Reitman just grew up on film sets and wealthy in LA, and all his movies are like Juno and what else does he do? Like
Manchester by the Sea. No.
Yeah. Depressing shit. And I think the more depressing the world is, the happier comedy gets.
I agree. Like, I can't even watch certain movies anymore. Like, every time that there's like a trauma film or like, it's like, oh, here's a sad take on this, this, I'm like, I don't even have the room for it. But I will spend all afternoon watching Godzilla versus Kong, knowing it's shit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. Or Mortal
I've
Kombat.
I've watched Mortal Kombat 3 times. It's one of the worst movies I've seen this year.
It's
like 3 times.
And it's 3 years ago, it was Moonlight, you know?
Yeah.
I bet the next Avengers movie gets nominated for a Best Picture Oscar, like a Best Original Screenplay.
I think that, yeah, comedy is going to get a lot more fun because all of the news isn't so rapid fire. Like, it used to be every day there was some type of new thing that was blowing up or a new dumpster fire that was happening. We had to all, like, address it on stage because we had to be the one that wrote the new bit about it. And then now, like, this Matt Gaetz thing has been happening for a month and a half. Like, there's no new information coming out at this point. And you're like, and if someone's like, oh, Matt Gaetz, we're like, all right, whatever.
Yeah.
I think about how much I watched the news during Trump. I would listen to the news every morning for probably 20 minutes at least. I would go to news sites, like a sickening amount, like at least 5 times a day. I would refresh some news site and check out the news stories to see what had happened in the last 30 minutes. Just because Trump was so entertaining. He was so exciting to watch. It made you feel angry, or maybe if you like him, maybe it made you feel excited, but he was such a constant source of news, which means I was spending hours a week consuming political news content. And I think you two were probably the same. Now I'm not. I check on Biden once a week, which is bad, but those hours are now spent watching television shows, watching scripted series, which means that's probably the case around the country, which means more eyes on scripted series or scripted series being produced. I'm looking forward to the scripted content, the television that's going to be made. And I look forward to hopefully booking something on one of those new shows. So that's what I think is going to result from COVID, from Trump, is just more TV and movies.
Is comedy in NYC dead?
No, and it never was. I'm stealing my girlfriend's joke, but it's a city where people love to go out because they hate their apartments. They their space is too small. They don't want to hear their roommates watching TV. So people here go out and do things and experience the culture. So there will always be an appetite for entertainment, especially live entertainment. And with COVID, you've realized there's no substitute for in-person being there in the room or on the rooftop, experiencing, witnessing people's emotion and energy firsthand. Best city in this country, hands down. And it's where it's happening.
Hey, if NYC is dead, then that means we're surrounded by a bunch of zombies. So I need all my zombies to say boo-boo.
Maybe say boo-boo, zombies. Boo-boo,
you know what I'm saying? This is 105 The Quiet Storm. I'm your host, Jackson Clemens. We run a Central Park show every Saturday at 8 p.m. We have such a really fun time. We have the city's best comics, and we're the host. It's on West 100th and Central Park West every Saturday, 8 p.m., unless it rains out. And every week, we like to bring some of the audio from the show so that you guys can get a sense of just how fun it is. So check out a clip from the show this week. I used to find all my gigs on Craigslist in Atlanta. And so one time there was a listing and it said, hey, we need a comedian to host an anniversary party at a swingers club. And I was like, yeah, no worries. I saw the price. It was way too much money to be doing comedy. It was $500. $500 in Atlanta is like 4 months rent. So
I was gonna be like, it was $45,000.
I was like, yeah, I'll do it. So I send in, you know, my tape and my headshot or whatever. And they go, hey, do you have a body shot? And I send it in. I'm like, this is weird, but okay. I send it in. And I was like, oh, well, they're like, we'd love you to do the show. What's up? Who's dying? Yeah, they're like, we love you to do the show, but just going to let you know, you have to do it naked. And I was like, $500 is $500. Let's do it. I'm 21. Like, I'll live forever. Let's go. So
$500. I wouldn't do that for, this is true, $650,000.
I've done a lot naked. What I'm saying is I done so much. Some of it for free. Most of it for free, really. So I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do it naked. And I'm hosting this.
Every time I'm bombing, in my head, I'm like, well, at least I'm not naked.
I will bomb naked. I don't care. So I'm at the show butt-ass naked hosting. I'm like, and it's the easiest show I've ever done. All hosting is at a swingers club is being like, who's fucking tonight? Super easy, right? And so I'm hosting, and there's these two girls that are standing there, and they're not laughing. They're just staring at me the entire time, right? They're even holding in their laugh. They're like, ha!
just staring. And I'm like, what is happening? So I get off stage. I'm like, oh, you two clearly didn't like the show. And they go, no, we loved it. Would you like to come see the upstairs? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go upstairs. Upstairs, there are six locked doors that you can like open and like do stuff in. And then there's two California king size beds on a loft. And there's a third girl on that bed. And she goes, oh, you brought them up.
What is happening?
I don't know, right? So I was like, oh, what is about to happen? And a foursome happened, actually.
What?
Yeah, I had a foursome, and I thought it was going to be amazing.
After comedy?
Yeah, after comedy. It was, yeah.
One time someone gave me $35 after comedy. I was like, wow.
I am standing.
A comedy foursome. Because of the four different bills they gave me. I was like, me, a 20, a 10, and a 5? Why? It must be some hot player.
It was weird. I thought it was going to be a fun time. But it was a lot like that scene in I Love Lucy with the conveyor belt. Mm. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. There's a lot of fingers and hands. I didn't know what to do with. So I actually ended up getting hired off of that.
Hey!
So the owner came up mid-coitus and was like...
That owner?
Yeah.
Lorne Michaels. That's we can catch about 11:30 tonight.
Yeah, he goes, I like your style, kid. We need a party starter. I was like, what's a party starter? And he goes, all these swingers parties, all they are just people talking about their wives and kids until someone starts having sex. That guy, he's a party starter. I need you. Like, he was like it was an Army recruitment video. And
this is a Boston recruitment video.
Yeah.
We got a wicked party starter.
Hey,
you freaking, we got big tuna.
And for a big tuna. For a month, I was a party starter. So honestly, weirdest show I've ever done, but most lucrative show in the long run.
My bad comedy show is that, so I had cancer when I was younger. I'm fine now. You can Venmo me. I did cancer. So I used to go to this cancer camp that was an Orthodox Jewish cancer camp. A niche. There was like 12 of us in the Poconos. Like, there was any more than that. I will say just quick aside, my favorite part about this camp was that all of the kids were Orthodox Jews, and then every day they'd bring up performers to perform at the camp, and none of these they bring up magicians and musicians and fire breathers and mind readers, and none of these people were Jewish. So a lot of times these were the first non-Jews that these Orthodox kids had ever met. So they would go home and their parents would be like, how was camp? And they'd be like, how was camp? I met non-Jews! And they're spectacular! I saw one on a bike fly! Like, so I used to go to that cancer camp, and then years later I got hired to speak at one of their events. I didn't know it was like their big money-making event, and it was in the hotel in Times Square. There was like 1,000 people there, and all of the tables were like owned by banks. It was like Chase bought 10 tables, and Wells Fargo bought 10 tables, and Lohman, it was all of those tables. So,
it's
right?
Weird that they'll buy all these tables, but they won't forgive me going to a different ATM.
No.
That's very weird.
You don't have
That's
cancer.
That's very weird.
You gotta get cancer.
That's 75?
No, cancer's how you get out of debt. Anyways, which is true. So I get hired to do this, and let me tell you right now, I bomb that fundraiser, okay? And this is how, can you imagine this? I was a cancer kid who bombed at a cancer fundraiser. Do you know how bad you have to be to bomb at a cancer fundraiser as a cancer survivor? And I bombed that fundraiser, and then afterwards they uploaded every single other person's video onto YouTube.
Oh,
not mine.
Crazy.
The YouTube channel. Okay, we got.
What if it was like, you know, all these other sets flared up, but this one went into remission.
Your comedy was worse than the atrocities of... Anyways, guys, we got Jeff who's going to tell his bad comedy stories. Jeff Ray, what's your bad comedy story?
When I was 15, my mentor at the time was like, oh, I got a show for you. And I was like, okay, I never got a show before. I was like, okay, let's go. And so I put it in the GPS, and we pulled up to a juvenile detention center. And I said, hey, man, you said a show, right? What is this? And he's like, yeah, no, you should ask questions next time, but this the show. So I go inside. He says, you got 10 minutes. I said, all right, cool. So I'm in there. I'm like, y'all ever been to school? And this kid just like stands up, looks at me, and sits back down. I don't know what that meant. But I literally turned a 10-minute set into 3 minutes. I was so nervous. I was like, yo, I got a future. I'm out. Peace. And, I,
and that so was you, it. You came into there, dunked on them.
Nah, but like, why was I met with hostility? I was trying to provide entertainment is all I'm saying.
You're the system that keeps them down. I give them every opportunity to succeed. What's wrong with them?
I literally, in the middle of it, I was like, why y'all mad at me? I didn't put y'all in here. I was just, here's the thing. You know what? I understand them a little bit. All right? Like, remember when you used to go to detention in high school or whatever?
Yeah.
And you hated it because, like, you had to stay after school and shit?
Yeah.
Imagine some dude coming in halfway through your detention and be like, y'all want to hear some jokes? Y'all trying to laugh today?
I didn't
know that. Come on the bus with your friends, could you?
It felt like the kids that got detention, I walked by the window and I was like, hey, I'm free.
You take out your phone in the middle and you're just like, all right, what else? All right, let's see, what else? You guys hear about Bitcoin? No, I don't know.
I looked off to my friend and he was like, hey, bro, I would just get off. Probably. I said, I knew that was it. I knew that was when I found my place in comedy. That was when.
Yeah, give it up a Jeffrey Wright, everybody!
You know, Drex, me and you perform at a comedy club in the city a lot called Stand Up New York on the Upper West Side. And what's interesting about Stand Up New York is that when every other comedy club in the city is sort of shut down, Stand Up New York used it as an opportunity to expand. And they were really the first legitimate club that was setting up outdoor shows. You know, when everything shut down in the city, the indie comedy community, the alternative comedy community, they were the ones that kind of came together and were starting to put up the shows in alternative spaces. And Stand Up New York was really the only club that had that, like, on the ground, you know, feet on the ground, like putting up shows in weird spaces and stuff. So they were the ones that started like shows in Central Park. So they took the coronavirus as an opportunity to kind of expand. And the owner has been kind of the person driving this expansion. His name is Donnie Zoldan, and we got to speak to him a little bit.
Yeah, he was super, super fun. And just to kind of give you guys like an example of like how innovative this club has been, like clubs do not leave their brick and mortar. They really don't. But they were in parks. They had a very successful show on the One Train. They were being as innovative as they possibly could be while also still being COVID safe. And honestly, they may have started a trend of comedy club innovation that comedy clubs are definitely going to have to reckon with as these indie shows get more and more popular.
They created an enemy.
Just like you think when you get superpowers that you just have them and you get to live free and fly around the city. No, now someone wants to put bionic legs on the back of themselves and challenge you to a fight, Doc Ock and Spider-Man style. And this is what Stand Up NY did. Okay. Now the indie scenes have something to compete with. So listen to this interview. I think you guys will have a really good time.
New York City is not dead. You know, it grabs people attention, obviously, that title, but New York City never died. It's never going to be dead. It might change, hopefully for the better. That's my view.
What are some of the changes that you've been seeing specifically within the comedy community?
I mean, physical spaces to perform, obviously. You know, I bet a year and a half ago or 14 months ago, you never would have thought you'd be performing on the One Train or in parks or in churches or on rooftops.
What was Stand Up NY like before coronavirus? How many shows were you doing? How many people were getting in and out of here?
I mean, Stand Up New York has been around for 35 years. I've owned it for 12 years with this guy by the name of Gabe Waldman. And then James bought in 3 years ago. And it was like your typical comedy club. You know, there's a cover charge, two drink minimum. We have 120 seats. It really wasn't anything special, which frustrated me because like I wanted a club with an awesome vibe and it was hard to stick out from other clubs. A lot of clubs get the same talent and, you know, I think people are a little tired of like two drink minimums and cramped seating and cover charges. So like I was itching over the years to like do something different. And, you know, Laugh Pass, which we started a few years ago, that was something, you know, that was different. It was a membership. It was $99 a year and you get unlimited admission to 35 clubs around the country. And it's sort of like a VIP experience. So there's no drink minimums. You get VIP seating. You get a text message when like when we hear a big name is coming in. So if like Seinfeld will drop in, we'd text Laugh Pass members, hey, Seinfeld will be in tonight. Come for your free seat, you know? So that was like something different. But overall, the past 12 years that I've been here, it wasn't like the most positive experience. I bought the club when I was 27, and you know, I've never operated a comedy club before, obviously. I've never worked in one before. I've only attended one as a fan. So it was a difficult road. And you know, I got a sense comics liked it, but like I got a sense from some comics that they didn't love coming to the Upper West Side. There was something missing, and I couldn't put my finger on it, and it was really frustrating. And then during the pandemic, you know, we got to be really creative, and I felt it was just a clean slate for us. You know, March, April, May last year, I was here every day when, you know, everyone was like indoors, everyone was in their apartment. I had a lot of time to just think and step away from the day-to-day of the club. You know, I used that time just to think about what we could do differently. And then we did Stand Up New York in the Park. We started in June, just when the weather started getting nicer. I started spending more time in Central Park. And when you were in the park in June, like you didn't really get a sense that there was a pandemic going on. You know, like Broadway, you sense like something was up, you know, especially last summer when a lot of homeless people were moving into the hotels on the Upper West Side. And a lot of people went to the Hamptons and Connecticut.
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld was never here.
Yeah,
Seinfeld. Let's be honest. He flies in every day to do shows. He flies right back.
He's a conspiracy.
Helicopter. Yeah. So, I mean, the park, I felt like, had a much different vibe than, like, the streets.
People were still hot in the park.
Yeah.
You can still look around and see people just being people.
People were sitting on the grass, having a picnic, throwing, you know, football. So I just had an idea. You know, I text John, our booker, like, hey, there's a ton of people out here in Central Park. Why don't I put together a show? It was just like a random idea that I came up with. And John was like, let's do it. And within a week, we put a show together. We had six comics. We paid them all. We had like 50 people come out. And it was awesome. You know, comics were really appreciative, you know, that we put this together. And
yeah, I performed at a bunch of them. And I definitely remember thinking like, oh, this is a little bit back to normal.
Yeah. And I mean, people were laughing again. And there was no other entertainment going on in the city. So that night, I knew we had something really special. And I told John, like, let's just scale this. Let's try to do like 50 shows a week. And we did it. We were doing like 40 to 50 shows a week. We did over 500 last summer.
So how does comedy change specifically for clubs post pandemic? Because now we're in a very interesting position where you have a ton of self-produced outdoor shows, plus a good bit of indoor shows coming in. And then now the club shows. And so now it's way larger smorgasbord of things happening. Like, yeah. So how do the clubs compete at this point?
First of all, I think the opportunities COVID created for comics is great. You know, like more opportunities to get on stage, whether it's in a club or on a rooftop or in a park or on Zoom. I mean, it's great. It's great for comics. And I think for clubs that are doing it also, I hate saying adapt or pivot, but, you know, I think it's important to adapt in situations like this, or else you're at risk of like closing down. There are a few clubs that closed, or a few that are just like hanging on by a thread.
Is it because they were like a lot of these clubs were already hemorrhaging before, and then the pandemic just exacerbated it? Or do you think that it was just the pandemic alone that like shut these things down?
I mean, I think it's different for every club. I mean, I think the comic strip, I don't know, I haven't seen their books, but you know, I think the perception is they've been struggling for a while. Their rent on Second Avenue, I'm sure, is a fortune. Also, and I think the owner died, so I don't think that helps.
Yeah, the situation. Their booker was, and this is true, 600 years old.
Yeah.
He was born in the 1200s.
No, they're like old school also. Yeah. You know, like they probably don't even have an email list. They probably have a mailing list.
And I've definitely seen that as like a problem with a lot of like bookers where when they are older, all they feel like it's the same process. Like you see some kid on stage, you're like, you got Mozzie, kid. Get over here.
What
you want to do Friday check spots? Great. Yeah. You know, and then
what do you got about Nixon?
Right. This will be a home club for the next 45 years.
Come to the back room with me.
right.
And after you started doing park shows, what was the next kind of evolution of that?
Yeah, so park shows, you know, we did in the summer and we did in the fall. And, you know, Saturdays we were doing like 10 park shows compared to before COVID, the club was doing like 3 shows on a Saturday.
And the shows were making money.
Yeah. Our ticket revenue is pretty good. We doubled our social following during COVID. You know, we really built a fan base, which we never had before. Like, I felt like we never really had a loyal following, but I feel like during the pandemic, we finally made that connection, which I was so frustrated the previous 12 years. I believe we finally made that connection to customers and comics also. And I feel really good about that. And then when it started getting cold out, I was just back to the drawing board. I was just, there's a few weeks of just like, you know, what do we do now? You know, like money's not coming in anymore from the park shows. The club's still closed.
I remember one time you called me up and you were just like, do you want to start a religion? Which was like, I think, because you're trying to like get the, because you're trying to get like religious exemption to like do shows and.
Yeah, because houses of worship were allowed to be open. And it was like during those few weeks when it was getting cold, you know, it's probably like October, November, like maybe we should do shows in churches, you know, because churches were open. So we actually legally created an entity called Temple of Laughter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we had a few phone calls. Eitan was on them, you know, just flushing out the beginning of our religion. I bet you that term has never been said before.
If comedy had a religion, what would be a commandment?
Oh, we did that.
Yeah, we really? There's a 10 commandments. Yeah, we were in 10 commandments.
For comics,
comedy.
It was like, those shall not heckle fellow comics. Those shall not run the red light.
Yeah. Thou shalt not be a dick about one free drink.
And we actually did a show in a church. We called it a service. The pastor spoke beforehand. And it was a beautiful service.
Opening, there was like this weird opening weekend.
April 2nd.
April 2nd. Yeah. So what was opening weekend like?
I wasn't here. Wow. I was in Miami.
Wow, okay.
I pulled a Ted Cruz. I was like all over social, like announcing, like, we're so excited to reopen. Yeah. And then I admitted I wasn't even here.
He was taking his daughters down.
I was taking my family down to Florida
really
for Passover.
Cold up here, April 2nd, a lot of rain. Right. I hope the power grid's working for you guys. Yeah.
The electricity's going. Whatever, screw you. No, guys. Now you're like, listen, I want to be at the clubs, but my daughters have to be in Miami for Passover.
I have to be a good dad. I have to be a good dad in this situation. I got to go with them.
Yeah. You know, they're first. I thought that was the right decision at the time. You know, I regret it. Yeah. And then I came back. You know, unfortunately, I missed opening night. But yeah, it was awesome. And we sold out shows. And from what I can see from the Nest cameras on my phone, it went smooth.
Is comedy in NYC dead?
Wait.
Yes, it is.
Walks away.
Yes, it is. Drops
mic. Completely dead.
No, I mean, I think the city would have been much different during COVID if like comedy wasn't here. Can you imagine? Like if there wasn't any stand up in the city during COVID.
No other arts came back at all.
Yeah. There's no like acting. There was no like not a lot of music. Which
there
was
not a lot of music, which was surprising. Yeah. I saw only a couple of times we'd be walking through the park and I saw like full band setups.
I'm kind of surprised.
They didn't want it
of
enough.
The lack of resilience by influential New Yorkers.
Yeah.
You know, obviously a lot like left and they went to Florida or Connecticut.
Well, the frustrating
thing. I was expecting to see some like cheesy, sentimental, like,
I don't know. I feel
New
like
York
comedy,
will come back commercials.
I feel like comedy needs less infrastructure than everything else. Like if you want to create a song, you have to have a producer. Yeah. You got to get people. You got to get the whole thing. And then you got to have people come out. With comedy, you throw a speaker and a microphone in a park.
That is true. I mean, but it also to the point though, is like, I feel like there were a lot of like high end New Yorkers, like Jerry Seinfeld, for instance, who was writing that like New York is still alive. It's alive. But like was writing it from the Hamptons and was writing it from nowhere near the city where like everything was happening.
You know what? To give him credit, I don't think he did much, but he did do more than some other well-known comics. I'm not naming names.
And what do you think those other well-known comics should have done?
Jerry did, you know, he was up there, you know, at Gotham, you know, with Schumer talking about Save Our Sages. It was important to see him up there. You know, he went to Gotham, you know, opening night. It was good to see him out. It would be great to see other big name comics that got their start in comedy clubs just support the industry more and go to all the clubs, you know, and you know, I don't think they should just support one club. I think they should support all the clubs and focus more time on just doing what they can to help the city come back. So no, New York City is not dead.
So is comedy dead in NYC? Hell no.
It was just having a drink between sets before its next big show.
Can you still be upstaged by a comic that's been home for a year? Then comedy isn't dead in NYC.
Can you bring an entire comedy club experience to the one train? Then comedy isn't dead in NYC.
Does my mom still ask me why I didn't get a better job as a lawyer or a doctor pretty much every day of the week? But you know what? That means comedy isn't dead in NYC.
In fact, comedy has become more innovative than ever. You can watch comedy on a rooftop in Brooklyn. You can watch comedy on a backyard in Brooklyn. And you can watch comedy at a comedy club in Brooklyn. And also the other three boroughs. Listen, because no one is taking a ferry to watch a comedy show in Staten Island. Sorry, Staten Island.
Is it what it used to be? No. But it'll be better for it, as the industry is always changing and growing. New York City is a wild, crazy, unbelievable place. And without comedy to ease us out, we'd just be Chernobyl.
So sum it all up, comedy in NYC is not dead. Don't listen to Donnie.
NYC is Dead is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producers are Julia Cassidy, Eden Sudley, Anna Marie Johnson, and Leslie King. This episode was produced by us, Drexen Clemens and Eitan Levine, a.k.a. the Pastrami Boys. This show is edited by Maureen Bigas.
You can follow us on Instagram at thisguydrex, at Eitan the Goalie, and at NYC is Dead Podcast. Or email the show at nycisdeadpodcast@gmail.com. See you next week.